all-access pass to everything White Sox.
Swing and a drive! Deep to left! Gone!
That was as hard as a baseball can be hit by anybody.
White Sox Weekly on the home of the White Sox, ESPN Chicago.
Now, here's your host, Jeff Mellor.
Happy Saturday to you. Welcome on in to White Sox Weekly. We do it each and every week. Here for you, hanging out, talking White Sox baseball, and of course, all things Major League Baseball. It is the Fall Classic. It has arrived last night, Game 1 between the Toronto Blue Jays and the Los Angeles Dodgers. And if we go back a week ago, last Saturday, I was talking about what might have been the greatest postseason game in the history of baseball by an individual. I'm talking, of course, about Shohei Ohtani's 3-home run game in which he also pitched and struck out 10. And last night, one of the few things Shohei Ohtani had not done happened when he homered.
Left it there, hit in the air to right field. Back it goes. It is gone. Yeah. Sky scraping home run from Shohei Ohtani. Left it over the plate, and Ohtani didn't miss.
Ohtani's first career home run in the World Series, but it was irrelevant for all intents and purposes because the Blue Jays hammered the Dodgers last night, 11-4. I think that's something that a lot of people may not have seen coming, especially when you consider Trey Yesavich, the Blue Jays rookie who began the season in A-ball, got the ball for Game 1 for Toronto. My, how things have changed. Think about this. We didn't learn who was going to be the Blue Jays Game 1 starter until Thursday. That's insane, and I think just speaks to how baseball teams approached their pitching in 2025. Nevertheless, though, Yesavich did wiggle out of a couple of jams. He gave the Blue Jays a solid outing, 4 innings, 5 strikeouts, only gave up 2 earned runs, and ultimately he was picked up when Addison Barger delivered the biggest blow of the game in the 6th.
Barger sends a towering drive right center field. Kiss it goodbye. Addison Barger has connected on a grand slam to break open Game 1 and start this place shaking.
Joe Davis on the call there on Fox, and it did indeed break the game open. That came in a 6th inning, the bottom of the 6th for the Blue Jays, in which they tallied 9 runs. And when you score 9 runs in an inning, you're not going to lose a game too often. The Blue Jays got to Blake Snell, and that gave them the opportunity. Blake Snell did give up 5 earned runs in this one. He has been outstanding for the last month to 6 weeks, basically unhittable. First time he really did get touched up in the postseason. And the Blue Jays got to him, but more importantly, I think they showed all of those watching and themselves, if they didn't already know it, the blueprint to beat the Dodgers, and that is to get into their pen. And the Blue Jays were able to do that last night. Emmett Sheehan, also for the most part a starter generally for the Dodgers, he came on, could not really get the Dodgers out of a jam. He gave up 3 earned runs, including that shot there. And there's just, if you're going to beat the Dodgers, you're going to have to do your best to get into their bullpen and make them pay. That's been their Achilles heel all season long, and that was exactly the difference in the game last night. The Blue Jays, I think some people, for the most part, because they're playing in Toronto, they're in the AL East, you may not be locked in on them like a lot of the better teams around baseball. And the way they've gotten to this point is they make more contact than any team in baseball. And it's funny because you'll oftentimes hear older fans say, hey, you know, just shorten up and go the other way. And there's a whole bunch of reasons why that's not necessarily the best approach to modern day baseball. You don't want to necessarily make weak contact. That's not necessarily the best game plan. But making contact and avoiding strikeouts, there's always going to be a place in the game for that. And the Blue Jays were the best in baseball at that all season long. They continue to do so in the playoffs. And what you saw last night was that there's plenty of power in that lineup as well. I didn't even mention Dalton Varsho connecting on a game-tying 2-run home run that really did give the Blue Jays a little extra juice that certainly helped pave the way. That came in the bottom of the fourth of our show with his home run. And there's just a lot of players in the Blue Jays lineup that can do damage, and that is certainly going to be their recipe for success if they're going to go on and win the World Series against the defending champion Dodgers. The Blue Jays also, I'll mention, they were able to do so without Vladimir Guerrero going deep, although he did have a couple of hits in this one, and maybe somewhat understated when you look at the final box score, but don't underrate the addition of Bo Bichette back in the Blue Jays lineup. Bichette had been dealing with a knee injury. He had missed the entire postseason. He was added to the Blue Jays World Series roster. And for the first time in his major league career, in game one of the World Series, Bo Bichette got the start at second base. That's right. Normally a shortstop. Now, we can talk about how Bo Bichette defensively is one of the worst defensive players at shortstop in all of baseball and has been over the last couple of years. But there's no doubt his ability at the plate is something that certainly lengthens the Blue Jays lineup. And to have him back hitting cleanup and then playing second base, and not just playing second base, but he made a fantastic defensive play moving to his right backhand and then fired to first. And so that's where the arm of a shortstop playing second base actually came into a little bit of, it was actually a strength for Bichette yesterday and the Blue Jays. So he was lifted for a pinch runner that did ultimately come around to score. But Bo Bichette back in the Blue Jays lineup certainly gives them a little bit of extra oomph as they will go through this World Series run. It will be interesting to see if the Blue Jays can use this and actually make it something that they can build on and go on and beat the Dodgers in the World Series. Of course, we are your home of the World Series right here on ESPN Chicago. Game two tonight coming your way right around 7 o'clock. It will be Kevin Gausman on the mound for the Blue Jays, and he will be opposed by Yoshinobu Yamamoto for the Dodgers. That game, again, coming your way tonight right around 7 o'clock. Speaking of the Blue Jays, worth mentioning now on White Sox Weekly, celebrate your special occasion in 2026 with a White Sox party area. Reserve your group outing today to get access to the best spaces and top matchups like opening day on April 2nd when the White Sox will be hosting, yes, that's right, the Toronto Blue Jays, who could be the reigning World Series champs. We shall see, but the White Sox will open next year against the Blue Jays at home. Other big matchups include the Cubs, Dodgers, and Yankees. For more information, visit whitesox.com/groups or call 312-674-1000. Jeff Meller here on White Sox Weekly. Quickly, I'll let you know that Carmen DeFalco is going to hop aboard and join me for a couple segments today. We're going to talk a little bit about the White Sox 2025 season coming up next. And also, today is the 20th anniversary of the White Sox Game 3 win against the Astros in Houston when Jeff Blum hits that iconic home run in extra innings in Houston that ultimately led the White Sox to go on and get a win and put them up 3-0 in the series against the Astros. And interestingly enough, too, last night's loss by the Dodgers, that was their second of the postseason, which means they cannot best the White Sox 11-1 record in the 2005 World Series. So, Sox fans, you can also take a little extra joy in the fact that the Dodgers cannot best the White Sox 2005 World Series run. I'm Jeff Meller here on White Sox Weekly. As I mentioned, Carmen DeFalco going to join me next right here on ESPN 1000.
This is White Sox Weekly.
White Sox Weekly.
On Chicago's home for sports.
On the ESPN Chicago app. 100.3 HD2 and ESPN 1000.
This is Chicago's home for sports.
On app.
The ESPN Chicago app.
In HD.
FM 100.3 HD2.
And of course on AM.
ESPN 1000.
This is White Sox Weekly.
Jeff Meller back here on White Sox Weekly. Stay up to date on all things White Sox by following the team's official social media accounts. Don't miss a minute of the action on and off the field. Follow at White Sox on social today.
back here, and I am pleased now to be joined in person by my good friend of over 20 years, Carmen DeFalco. You, of course, know him from Carmen and Yurko fame if you're listening here on the flagship station, ESPN 1000. And Carm, I always think whenever someone says they're a lifelong White Sox fan, I think you actually trump them because you made the decision in your life as a young boy to switch allegiances when you had a house divided.
Yeah.
For those who are unfamiliar with your backstory, please fill in White Sox fans and how you became a White Sox fan.
Yeah, it's I made this choice, and I will live with it. I'll ride with it. I'll die with it. I did make this choice. My dad is a Cub fan. My grandpa, his dad, who grew up here in Chicago, was a huge Cub fan. And while my dad never really had too much animosity towards the White Sox, my grandfather did. He, for whatever reason, was, you know, he very much had it in his mind and his heart that he disliked the White Sox. My dad was sort of like, whatever. He liked taking me and my brothers to games.
Yeah.
I think, and, you know, the career in which he worked, he had a lot of access to tickets when we were young. And I think he really enjoyed bringing us to games. Hawks games, Cubs games, White Sox games. So he wasn't shy about taking us to Old Comiskey Park when I was very young. And that was probably a little bit of the start of it. I was in 84. I was, how old would I have been? I guess I was 7 that summer. Mm-hmm. I would have been turning 8 at the end of the year. And it was really the first summer I can remember sort of being wrapped up in a team that meant something to me. And of course, that was the 84 Cubs. I was just sort of old enough to start understanding, to follow teams, to watch these games. And I've told the story before. Yeah, I cried in the backyard of our Berwyn bungalow when the Cubs blew that lead. They blew the series lead, and then they lost that game 5 in San Diego. I cried. And so I think that's maybe sometimes surprising for people to hear because I do love the White Sox so much, and I don't cheer for the Cubs, and I don't really like them. I made the choice about late 80s when, you know, Robin and Frank and Ozzy, I really liked Ozzy a lot. He was one of my favorite players. They were getting ready to move into the new park, and I was a kid in grade school and junior high, and that was kind of an exciting time. They changed the logo, the color scheme. There was just like an exciting time, I think, to be wrapped up in the White Sox. And so I did flip allegiances despite my grandfather's advice against it. And like I said, my dad wasn't – he never said, oh, you can't do that. Or he was sort of, well, whatever. He just liked being – at games with me and my brothers. I think it was something he didn't really get to experience as a kid. You know, it wasn't part of his childhood growing up. And so he really liked sharing that with us. And so it's not like even though he was a Cub fan, I never was at, as my father calls it, Sox Park. Cubs Park and Sox Park. I think a lot of the old time Chicagoans, my grandfather used to do the same thing. It was either at Cubs Park or Sox Park, but he would take us. And so I got exposed to the Sox young, even though he was a Cub fan. And somehow I gravitated towards them, and that's the decision I've made.
Hey,
so I have to live with it, Jeff.
Listen.
and I will. I live proudly with it.
But part of, you know, it's funny because I identify somewhat with that because my mom is a Cubs fan. My dad is a Cubs fan. They're divorced, so I would go back and forth, and they like your dad. They didn't really hate the White Sox, but my best friend and his dad were diehard White Sox fans, and they took me to a lot of games on the South Side, primarily at New Comiskey Park.
Yeah, New. Yeah.
But I did go to plenty of games at Old Comiskey Park with my dad when I was younger, so I do remember that, but definitely in the early 90s, a lot of fondness for, you mentioned those teams, Jack McDowell,
yes.
Alex Fernandez.
Yes.
And you mentioned the rebranding, something that we've talked about quite a bit on White Sox Weekly. The black and white pinstripes,
yes,
and the hats that was, you know, embraced by the hip-hop era really did make being a White Sox fan cool.
Yep.
And then Frank Thomas was just literally and figuratively larger than life on the baseball field. So it was a fun time to be a White Sox fan. And, of course, we were very well rewarded in 2005 when you live and die with the White Sox and they come back and win the World Series. And we're going to touch on that a little bit more here in the next segment. But last season was tough, Carm. And when I say last season, 2024 was a tough year. The White Sox, of course, lost 121 games. This season in 2025, they make a 19-win improvement, which that's quite substantial.
Yeah.
That's what I keep framing it when people say, listen, they still lost 100 games for the third time in a row. Well, 19-win improvement is huge in baseball and is not something to be underestimated. How did you take in this last season, and what are your thoughts on a grander scale about what you saw?
Well, it was much more enjoyable for, and I don't know that you can ever, I don't know that a fan base will ever get as much out of a 100-loss season as White Sox fans got out of this year, like ever, seriously. And I think a lot of that, Jeff, is baked into just how much more fun the second half of the season was. Because all of a sudden, over the final couple months, they really did look like a much more respectable team. I think they fought hard. I think the messaging inside that clubhouse was different and better. I think you can make a little bit of a comparison to what the Bears are experiencing with new management, new voices, a different coaching staff. I think a lot of Will Venable. I thought it was a really good and smart choice when they made it. I don't think quite, if I'm permission to speak freely, I don't think it's an organization that's always made good choices. I think that's an understatement probably. I mean, most people would agree with that, and it's why it's gotten them where they've gotten. But I thought that was a really smart hire. I just like the approach to it, the kind of guy they were looking for, considering who he's been around. And then you start talking to other people in baseball that almost unprompted tell you, oh, no, that's really a good hire. That's smart. This guy gets it. You know, I went to high school with Jerry Harrison Jr., and I still talk to Jerry quite a bit. We text quite a bit. And I knew they had brief overlap as teammates. Obviously, they sort of shared the league as players at the same time, but they also had a brief overlap as teammates. And, you know, Jerry spoke the world of him. I mean, immediately he said, and he loves the White Sox. I mean, he really does. He loves Jerry Reinsdorf. He loves what Jerry had always done for his dad, for Jerry Sr., who coached in the organization for a long time. I mean, he very much has some love in his heart for the organization, and he couldn't stop raving about what he thought Will would bring to this team and what he'll bring. So I think those things are trending in a very good direction to make me more encouraged about the future more than anything. And I just love the way they played in the second half. There can be noise in second half numbers. I get it. Teams get to mid-August, they're out of it. They, you know, like it's sometimes hard to look too deep into what goes on in late August and September in baseball. But I just appreciate the way they played, what a better effort it was, and how good some of the young players looked in the second half of the season.
And I'll add to that, Carmen DeFalco joining me here on White Sox Weekly. Getting a chance to cover Will Venable this year at home games where, you know, I'm in attendance for, there's no doubt that he was the right man for this job. And the problem was, it's a Herculean task to go back to, you know, a 19-win improvement only getting you to 60 games. There was a lot that needed to be cleaned up for the White Sox. And I have no doubt that Will Venable is going to put this organization in position in the future to get the most out of the talent on the field. That, to me, is unquestionable what I saw from him this year. And I like the fact that Will Venable understood that it was going to be a learning year for him. I think that's why it synced up well, and why I continue to be encouraged, is because the White Sox identified him as a good leader and somebody they wanted to be the front man for the organization. And I think anybody who comes into a new job, you're going to have some growing pains. It's just the reality of the situation, a first-time manager. And what I saw from Will Venable this year was somebody who wasn't too big for he didn't think, oh, okay, he didn't have a massive ego and say, "This, I'm the manager now, this is how it's going to be, I'm going to immediately make changes." He understood that he needs to learn a lot, and he embraced the idea of bringing his coaching staff in and, you know, helping him in the process. And I think he's only going to grow. And I think he has a clear command of the clubhouse. And I think it's in 2025, it's a whole different ball game. Oh, yeah. I think you, for the most part, you need somebody who's going to keep it positive. Now, I'm not saying that there isn't times when the stick isn't needed. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure, like, from what I could pick up, there were moments where Will Venable was absolutely willing to tell his players internally, hey, this isn't good enough. We need to do things better. But at the same time, publicly, I think it's just a whole new generation, Carm. And I think that positive spin that Will Venable keeps inside the clubhouse publicly is going to serve him and the organization really well.
I think that's a great point. There is a different way that you have to connect to players in this day and age, whether you like it or not. I think we probably even see it at a very youth level, like with the involvement that our kids have in sports, or that anybody that's got kids that are playing any degree of travel or high school athletics. I think you're seeing more and more the different ways that coaches are trying to connect. That, not that you can't be hard or push hard or coach hard, but it was a lot different even at low levels when we were kids, and the perception of what a coach had to be and how you kind of had to coach, and certainly what it was like at the big league level or at any professional level. I think anybody would tell you that whether we like it or not, it's not going to go backwards in all likelihood. It's just a different sort of era, and it's a different kind of message, and you have to relate to guys in a different way. And I think the good managers and the good coaches across various sports understand that, and they're good at it. And you know it better than I. I'm glad to hear you say it. It seems like Will understands that, and everybody I've talked to sort of agrees with that. And you've got the personal experience of seeing it up close. That's a good thing. That's a positive sign going forward.
And now the talent just needs to catch up to the manager. And to your point, the second half was very encouraging for White Sox fans. Colson Montgomery in particular was, in a lot of ways, the story of the season for the White Sox. When we go back to what happened for him in April, he had to shut down his AAA season, go to the Arizona Complex League, and work individually with Ryan Fuller. And that's something that I'll give the White Sox credit for doing, being open to the idea that, listen, this is somebody who has a lot of talent. He needs time to rework his swing. Colson Montgomery was open to doing it to get better. And then all of a sudden, the light went on, finally got to the majors. And basically from the 4th of July on, Colson Montgomery never really looked back. It seemed like his trajectory was almost straight up. Your thoughts on what you saw from the White Sox young shortstop this past year?
I loved it. I honestly, I mean, he was probably one of the 20 or 25 best hitters in baseball, to your point, after July 4th. I mean, I think you can dig into some of the metrics.
Well, if we really want to get granular, as soon as he took the torpedo bat in Tampa. So, you know, it took him a little bit of time, obviously, a couple weeks prior to the All-Star break, where every player, once they're in the majors, they're probably wide-eyed like, okay, this is big league pitching. But as soon as after the All-Star break, he picked up the torpedo bat, 22 home runs in the second half.
It's incredible. I'm hoping that, like...
21,
yeah. I don't know. We'll see next year with a full year and adjustments and all that. Like, it's way too early. We don't know yet. It's way too early in his young career to really know fully what he is. You know, what I've talked about a lot with White Sox fan friends of mine, I think we've even talked about it, like, what's Colson Montgomery ultimately going to be? Is he going to be a 225 hitter with a 305 on base? Like, I could live with that if he's got 65 extra base hits every year. Like, if the power was real, and we've always heard about it. So if the power's real and it's going to play and he's going to hit 30 home runs and, you know, 30 doubles or 35, 32 doubles every year, like, you're talking about a very impactful offensive player. Do I ever see a 360 on base guy? Probably not. I'd love to be wrong. Probably not. But he played, for the most part, above average defense, and he hit the crap out of the ball. And when he gets into it, you see the natural raw power. He hits it hard. He hits far. And I think there's a lot of promise there. And they've historically, unfortunately, screwed up players like that with that profile and some of their best prospects. And maybe this time, really hit it out of the park with what you said, taking a chance and saying, well, this has never really been done before, but let's try it. We're sending a guy back out to Arizona.
Yes.
In the midst of a season, and when it happened, we were like, oh, my God, this is devastating, and I'm so glad we've
I remember texting you.
I know. I couldn't believe it.
And I was like, this is not exactly what I want to hear, but just letting you know, because you were on the air with Yurt.
Yeah.
And I was like, just to give you guys a heads up, Colson Montgomery's going back to Arizona to work individually with Ryan Fuller.
I couldn't believe it, and that it's worked out, at least at this point, and if he turns out to be everything we expect and hope, like, wow, the Sox really did something different, and they did it well, and they helped bring along one of their young players with an enormous amount of talent and potential.
It's funny, too, because you mentioned something, Carmen DeFalco joining me here on White Sox Weekly. We're going to take a quick break here in a moment, and we'll reminisce about the 2005 World Series winning team, the 20th anniversary this past week it'll be the 20th anniversary tomorrow on Sunday of them winning the actual World Series. But we're going to talk a little bit about that because Carmen was in attendance for all of those World Series games. He went down in Houston to watch it. But you said something that I always kind of have to have this internal battle with. You talked about Colson Montgomery's batting average. And it's like we grew up in this era where everybody looked at their batting average. And you almost have to like chastise myself. Like it almost doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It's like just look at the on-base percentage.
Right.
The batting average, because the extra base hits matter.
Right.
It is so hard to get base hits in baseball in 2025. Batting average doesn't matter. if he can get the on-base percentage to somewhere around 330, it was 311 in his rookie season. Mm-hmm. If he can consistently be a 330 to 340 guy, it doesn't need to be 360. If he's giving you phenomenal 30 to 40 homers, that, my friends, is a winning baseball yes player, especially if he can handle shortstop the way he did in his rookie season in the second half here. You've got a superstar player.
100%. Totally agree. You've got a five-win player. I mean, you've got the kind of thing that teams need to change a lineup. It's slug. We know it. What do teams spend on when they spend big in free agency when it comes to position players? They spend on slug.
Yep.
That's what – and so if you have it internally and you can ride that and you can get the most out of it in his prime, it's huge. So, yeah, he can hit 225. I don't care as long as we're seeing an ability to get on base and he continues to have the kind of power that played this year, because that is huge and that's what changes the lineup. And in this day and age, that's really what matters. And it's usually leads to a good offense and winning baseball.
One last thing on this year's team and going forward. So what else are you excited about with the White Sox for 2026 based on what you saw this past year?
Well, I would say like the next wave of guys I think is going to be interesting, and mostly the pitchers who we didn't get to see this year, like when they're up next year. I mean,
Hagen Smith, Noah Schultz.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. I continue to be intrigued by what I hear about Braden Montgomery, too. I mean, it looks like they already did about as well. I never liked the crochet thing. I've kind of ranted about that. It looks like they've done well, though. And if Braden hits, you'd say, okay, maybe they did really well. And from what I've heard, it's a lot as positive and good. I know I have a couple of Red Sox fans. I have a friend of mine who's a very big diehard Red Sox fan and continues to lament the fact, as much as he loves crochet, has continued to, you know, through the pipeline stuff he still follows. He loves the Red Sox so much that, man, they feel like they maybe let a really, really good one get away. And I'm like, listen, you got Garrett Crochet. You got nothing to complain about because Crochet's fantastic.
The proverbial win-win trade
that
for
could
both
be
teams.
That could be.
And Kyle Teal.
And Kyle Teal, too. I mean, I know. He's mentioned a few times. He's like, man, and he's got a real thick Boston accent, too. The Brady Montgomery thing. He keeps seeing at every turn. He's like, man, the White Sox might really have a special player. I hope that's the case. We'll see.
He's Carmen DeFalco. I'm Jeff Meller. This is White Sox Weekly. We'll take a quick timeout and come back and reminisce a little bit about the 2005 World Series champion White Sox right here on ESPN 1000.
Follow Chicago's Home for Sports on Twitter at ESPN 1000.
Welcome to White Sox Weekly on ESPN 1000.
Longest game in the World Series history. Blum hits it into right, down the line. It is gone. Jeff Blum, the former Astro, goes deep. And here in the 14th inning, the White Sox take a 6-5 lead. Jeff Blum gets his first at-bat of this series and only his second of the postseason.
Ah, yes. 20 years ago today, the White Sox went up 3-0 on the Houston Astros. That game, of course, in Houston, as they would eventually go on to sweep Houston for their World Series win back in 2005. Carmen DeFalco hanging out with me for another segment here on White Sox Weekly. As we just hit on the 2025 White Sox, we're gonna reminisce about the good old days. It is the 20-year anniversary, of course. Hey, White Sox fans, get access to the best seats at the best value and lock in a 2026 ticket plan today. Be here for the biggest matchups, exciting new promotions, and opening day on Thursday, April 2nd. Plus, enjoy flexible payment plans, savings on single games, and more. To secure your ticket plan, visit whitesox.com/2026. All right, Carm, what do you remember about that day in particular? Jeff Blum with the home run in Houston in the 14th inning to give the White Sox a 7-5 lead, a game that Mark Burley would come on to actually save.
Everything about it. I mean, Sylvie and I were together watching that game in Houston. We were down. We were down behind a little bit behind the left field foul pole. So in the opposite side where he hit that home run, but that's where we were, our seats for games 3 and 4. And we just kept saying to each other as that game was going on, like, we're seeing something crazy and something memorable that we're never going to forget as it went deeper and deeper into the night. And occasionally we were also in commiserating with some fans around us. Sylvie and I were working 9 to noon back then, like Yurko and I are now. We're like, man, the wake-up's going to come pretty early here. It's getting a little late, but it was
at 2 in the morning.
I mean, it was so much fun. We knew we were watching something really special, like each pitching staff just getting big outs and big outs when it mattered most, when the game was tied for all those innings. It was remarkable, and I remember when he did hit that home run thinking, if they close this out now, I remember thinking, it's going to be 3-0. And now this was just a year after the Red Sox had completed that very historic comeback. But still, it was like, they got a 3-0 lead. I'm like, if they close, and then when Burley did close it out, I'm like, I think I even said to Sylvie probably, like, they're going to win the effing World Series.
Yes.
I'm like, they're going to win the World Series. And we knew we would be back in that building again later that night. And it was, it was almost like a blur after that, that next 24 hours or 36 hours, just incredible. But I remember thinking in that moment, like, that they survived that game.
Yes.
And then it was no longer, okay, they took a 2-0 lead, but, you know, you're going down. It was like, they're up 3-0. They're going to win. Their pitching is too good. It's been too dominant. They're going to win the World Series. And it was an incredible feeling.
And it's crazy now because I'm thinking back to, you know, not just the World Series run, but the entire playoff run. We've talked a lot the last, basically, all of October about the run that the White Sox pitching had in the ALCS against the Angels, where you had four straight complete games, and how different baseball is nowadays. It's Saturday now, but we just had game one of the World Series last night, and on Thursday of this week, we didn't even know who the starting pitcher for the Blue Jays was going to be in game one. And think about how different baseball is nowadays, where the White Sox, on the strength of their pitching, you know, cruise through the ALCS, and then, you know, they really did dominate the Astros. That was really the only game.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess you had Konerko and you had Pitsednik. So, but it just felt like inevitable the way the White Sox stormed through the postseason that year.
It totally did. And 20 years ago, yeah, that's a long time ago, but it's not 50 years ago that the game has changed so much in this period of time, where young fans today that only know this type of baseball, I mean, I can't imagine what goes through their mind as they try to, like, conceptualize that, right? That you have one, two, three, four, that the roles were so defined and that those guys would be as dominant as they were against some of the best competition at the highest pressure, highest stake times of the year. I mean, it is. I mean, think about how much we celebrated the fact that what the Dodgers did in the NLCS this year, getting 8 and then 9 out of Snell and
Yamamoto.
Yes. I mean, that was incredible, and it doesn't even really hold a candle to what the White Sox
did. And we should comment on this, because part of the reason I think the Dodgers are willing to lean on their starting pitching is because this
is where stinks.
Well, that, but also this is where their financial flex really comes into play, right?
Yeah.
The Dodgers all season long babied their starting pitching throughout the regular season. You know, if you look at the innings totals for Snell and Yamamoto and Glasnow.
Shohei.
Coming back
from injury, like, but think about how careful they were.
They slow played it knowing that their lineup could basically get them through the regular season into the playoffs. And then in the playoffs, if they could just get their rotation healthy enough that they could lean on their starters late in the season, this is where the difference between your salary, actually your payroll, actually matters. As you look at what the Dodgers are doing versus everybody else around baseball, there's no other team that can treat the regular season like that.
I think you're absolutely right. Like, the Brewers basically had to hold that rotation together with duct tape. The Cubs would have to do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
The Cubs were tapped. I mean, had they won that game five, they were spent. They were tapped. I think the Blue Jays can give them a little bit of, you've got a couple of guys maybe you trust. It would have been better, I think, had the Mariners won. Had the Mariners not blown that lead, I think it would have matched up a little bit better, because I think they had the pitching to do it. I had been thinking for about the last 6 weeks that the Mariners were going to win it this year. I liked their pitching. I liked their ability to hit it out of the park. And I kept telling Black and Abdallah and York, I'm like, guys, I think we missed the boat. You know, we never pulled the trigger on the Mariners. We talked about it when they were, like, still 18-1 or 16-1. And then before you knew it, we got into September, and it was like, now they're 5-1. And it's like, that's it. We missed it. Now, obviously, we didn't, because they didn't win. I thought they would have been able to kind of match up a little bit better with the Dodgers.
But the truth is, you know, short series, you never know what's going to happen. Seven-game series.
You never do.
But this is where the Dodgers' financial might actually end up being a true difference in this whole.
And it's what gave the Sox such an advantage 20 years ago, because those guys just,
they
were good. They had a good season, obviously, and those pitchers had, Contreras was incredible in the second half of the season that year. Burley was Burley. Garland finally put it together. And you're like, okay, this is real. And then they all caught
Freddie Garcia. Freddie Garcia was his typical 15-win guy back when wins mattered. And you actually, that's the other thing, too. It's just crazy looking at, I know you're a stats nerd like me, just looking at the pitching stats across baseball. And it's just, that's why I look, in some ways it feels like yesterday, the 2005 season. And then others, when you look at it, you're like, boy, it is a completely different ball game.
Totally.
Because, you know, if you pitch 200 innings, you basically are going to be at the top three in all of baseball. Yeah. Meanwhile, the White Sox were leaning on four starters who basically went 200 innings that season, and nobody thought twice about
nobody
it.
Nobody thought twice.
Okay, now you have a chance to lean on your rotation. It was just such a fun year, and it's been fun to just kind of look back at that season on the 20-year anniversary of the White Sox win over the Astros. So that was obviously game three. We heard Blum's highlight. How about game four? You actually had a unique way of watching the White Sox celebrate because you mentioned you and Sylvie. You actually had an opportunity to kind of see the after party.
We showed up at the after party, which I think was more just like by pure chance. If I'm remembering correctly, I'm pretty sure the White Sox had scheduled after game four. This was planned before the series. They had no idea they were going to be up 3-0.
Yeah.
And they had scheduled an after party after game three. After game four for everybody in the, obviously we're going to do it after a game five. You're going to be flying back home. They had scheduled it for all the employees. Jerry, to his credit, did, sometimes I rip Jerry a lot. So I'll give Jerry some credit. He flew pretty much the whole organization down to Houston, and they had scheduled something back at the team hotel, a little get together for mostly the employees and some close family and friends. And somehow Sylvie and I don't want to say weaseled our way. We were invited. And we were given a couple of passes when I picked up my World Series. I bought four tickets. I paid for them. I bought four tickets. I bought two tickets, to all four or to every game of the World Series, all seven games, because I knew we were going to be in Houston. So I bought two tickets to every game. I took my dad to the first game. I took my brother to the second game. And then Sylvie and I were together at games three and four. And so in the envelope, when I had picked up my tickets, there were these passes left. And it's like, come to this little shindig we're going to have after game four. Turns out they sweep. Turns out that they're parading the trophy in. Ozzy is telling Sylvie and me to go bleep off in a very loving way, as only he can. I love Ozzy, and I think Ozzy likes us a little bit too. It was remarkable. And sure enough, the trophy's there, and the players are there, and we're up till 5 in the morning drinking and celebrating. Sylvie, not as much. He was just having a good time. He's a Cub fan, obviously. But I think he was happy to see me celebrate as much as I did as a good friend, and it was remarkable.
And then you were back on the air about 4 hours later.
We were back on the
celebrating
air.
Celebrating a White Sox World Series title.
2 hours later. That's exactly right.
Fun reminiscing. Carm, thanks so much for hopping on White Sox Weekly with me. I appreciate it. Of course, you can hear Carmen with Yurko every Monday through Friday from 9 to noon, right here on ESPN 1000. Hey, Sox fans, sign up to become a White Sox insider and get special offers, single game ticket presales, and other exciting Sox content delivered free to your inbox. Visit whitesox.com/insider today. We'll come back and wrap it up right here on ESPN 1000.
This is Chicago's home for sports.
On app.
The ESPN Chicago app.
In HD.
FM 100.3 HD2.
And of course on AM.
ESPN 1000.
This is White Sox Weekly.
Celebrate your special occasion in 2026 with a White Sox party area. Reserve your group outing today to get access to the best spaces and top matchups like opening day on April 2nd, plus big matchups against the Cubs, Dodgers, and Yankees. For more information, visit whitesox.com/groups or call 312-674-1000. Jeff Meller back here on White Sox Weekly as we wrap up this week's edition. I did want to mention a documentary that I watched this past week, baseball documentary on Netflix called Who Killed the Montreal Expos? It was released on Tuesday, and I was anxiously awaiting the documentary to drop because I always say the Expos for a long time were kind of my de facto second baseball team, my de facto second favorite baseball team. They were kind of the National League team that I cheered for back before interleague play was a thing. Those of you who are older may remember, like, or may have been like me, where you kind of had a National League team. You obviously cheer for the White Sox in the American League, but you had a National League team that you kind of followed a little bit more because just to kind of keep up to date with both leagues. And for me, the Montreal Expos, the uniqueness of a Canadian team. Of course, you had the Blue Jays, who are in the World Series this year, but you had Montreal and Toronto. And for me, the Montreal Expos were the National League ball club that I rooted for. And so I was, and I it, that's since definitely fallen away, not just because the Expos would leave and go to the go become the Washington Nationals, but also because once interleague play started to happen more regularly and it became something that Major League Baseball truly embraced, and now you have the DH across all of baseball, the differentiation between the leagues kind of fell by the wayside. But for me, growing up, the Montreal Expos were my National League ball club. So I was very interested to see this documentary by Netflix, to the point where I set a reminder and it popped up on Tuesday. I was like, oh, yeah. So I checked it out. It's about 90 minutes long. And I will quickly, I will give you the tip. If you're like me, I would highly recommend flipping to the, there's a, if you go to the settings on your Netflix, you can watch in French. And the reason I say this is because most of the documentary is in English. Most, you know, most of the people interviewed are native English speakers or people like Pedro Martinez. They speak in their second language in English. However, there are, because there's lots of people who are French Canadian who are interviewed in this documentary, they are speaking in French. And I don't know about you folks out there, but it drives me absolutely insane to watch a documentary and watch somebody speak and then know that the overdub isn't synced to their lips. It's just maddening to me. And there's not, it's not the whole 90 minutes of, you know, French speaking. It's intertwined between a lot of English. And so I will tell you, I started watching the first 2 or 3 minutes. I couldn't take it. I was like, this is insane, watching so many people speaking French, but then listening to the English overdub. For me, it was maddening. So I quickly flipped, and I will tell you, just reading the subtitles in English for the French speaking, it made a huge difference, and it was much more enjoyable to me. Nevertheless, I digress. I still didn't love the documentary. And granted, the documentary is titled Who Killed the Montreal Expos? However, I think Netflix and the makers of the documentary failed in establishing the nostalgia for the Expos. They just didn't roll up their sleeves and get into the history of the Expos enough, I think, for people to really care about the story. Now, it's not that it was bad, but I don't think they did enough to, there's so much history with the Expos. I think they really did drop the ball when it came to establishing the success that they had. Specifically, I will tell you, I did not watch enough. I was too young to really appreciate the Expos in the 80s, but they had a lot of great players. Tim Raines, former White Sox player who, you know, made a Hall of Fame career primarily on the strength of what he did with the Expos. Andre Dawson, who, you know, in the city of Chicago, most of his prime was played with the Montreal Expos. Gary Carter, another great player in the 80s who went on to a history of success with the Mets where he won a World Series. His best years came as a Montreal Expo. I don't think they did enough to establish the Expos' history to really make you care for the city of Montreal. So all in all, it's an interesting documentary. And if you're curious about why the Montreal Expos ended up leaving and then becoming the Washington Nationals, it digs in deep on that. I just don't know, though, if you're not somebody who truly cared about the Montreal Expos, I don't know if the documentary does enough to establish why people of Montreal truly loved that team and cared about it. So for a documentary that I was very excited about, I thought it missed the mark just a little bit. And I'm a baseball fan, so that was somewhat disappointing to me. Probably still, if you're a baseball fan out there and you love documentaries, probably still worth 90 minutes. But I was just a little bit, I think they came up a little bit short. So there's my 2 cents, little film review for you here on White Sox Weekly. I'm Jeff Meller. That's going to do it for us this week here. I want to say thank you to Carmen DeFalco for spending some time with us. Brendan Riley, the executive producer of White Sox Baseball and White Sox Weekly, here with me as well. We will talk to you again next week right here on ESPN 1000.